If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Medicine in America, hosted by Anthony Manson and Todd Harrington, shares the stories of physicians, other healthcare professionals, and industry leaders who are changing the way we deliver care. There's an episode that you should check out called Primary Care Reimagined with Subscription-Based Preventative Care Model. It's an inspiring call for a paradigm shift in primary care. All of their episodes highlight innovative ideas at the forefront of the movement to transform our healthcare system. Check out Medicine in America on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. This is episode 106 of the podcast. If you're a new listener, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is your place for trusted health guidance and resource. Whether you're looking to improve your health or just seeking ways to stay well, we're here for you. This growing community is on a mission to improve our state of being and experience together on the planet. And if you love the thoughtful and informative content you get here, it might be time to consider becoming a health amplifier today. You can support this community over at patreon.com/highwaytohealth. Every dollar goes towards the development of resource toward a more integrative approach to care. Thanks for your support. My guest for today's show is Jonathan DePotter, founder and CEO of Behold Retreats, a wellness service that facilitates journeys of self-discovery and transformation, including the use of plant-based medicine. After getting to the top of his game as a corporate consultant and objectively living a great life, he had a transformative experience with the aid of plant-based medicine that completely changed his life and focus. And he has since devoted himself to the development of programs and retreats for self-discovery and development. My interest in the therapeutic use of plant-based psychedelics was sparked in recent years with Michael Pollan's coverage of the use of psilocybin with the terminally ill at Johns Hopkins, and later in his book, How to Change Your Mind, where he writes about the history of the therapeutic use of psychedelics, as well as his own experience with therapist-led experiences using different forms of plant-based medicine at the ripe young age of 60. He's been quoted a number of times saying that perhaps psychedelics have been wasted on the young, because as he explains, there are a number of coping mechanisms, habits, traumas, and lifelong patterns that as we get on in age are harder to shift from. And the evidence being gathered for the use of plant-based medicine in the healing of things like trauma, anxiety, depression, substance and alcohol addiction, smoking, anorexia, and even Alzheimer's are showing far better results than anything in modern medicine. That's not to say that mental and emotional therapy support, the work I'm engaged in every day in my practice, isn't beneficial. In fact, I believe it to be an essential part of self-care. But many of our health insurance-supported therapies aren't addressing the underlying spiritual crises that lead to poor lifestyle choices impacting not only our physical, mental, and emotional health, but all of our relationships at some level. As Jonathan and I discuss here, once these base-level problems can be healed, there's new potential for emotional and spiritual growth that opens up possibilities for self-acceptance and a deeper understanding of our interconnectedness and a greater sense of purpose. Here's my conversation with Jonathan DePotter. You're in Thailand, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Did you center yourself there because of the business and because of where retreats are going to be?
No, so I actually moved here 4 years ago now, and I had the opportunity to establish and build the local office for a global consulting firm. So I spent the first 2.5 years that I was here establishing and doing the consulting thing. Digital strategy and digital transformation programs for the local Thai banks and a few multinational banks and insurance companies as well.
Okay.
But throughout that duration, I was kind of preparing for an entry into this line of work and an exit from that world.
So how long have you been kind of preparing to do this kind of thing? Did you have an idea from your own experience?
Yeah.
Or how did that come together?
Yeah, so I had attended a number of retreats over the years, and those had been really beneficial to me. And then it was the time, you know, for me personally, it was when I discovered some childhood trauma and was able to release that. That was the day and the moment that I was like, wow, there's so much more here than is generally acknowledged and recognized. And if I've got these memories that are so locked away that, you know, my waking consciousness doesn't have them, then I'm sure other people do too. And yeah. That's certainly the case. So that was, for me personally, that was the real aha moment. And it's been about 3 years, probably just over 3 years since then, really preparing and now entering the space.
You grew up in Hawaii, is that right?
Yeah.
That was where you were born and raised?
So moved to California when I was four. My mom was, I was born in Greece, moved to Belgium, so I'm actually a Belgian citizen now.
That's funny. I had a feeling because I have some good friends from Antwerp and I saw the last name and I know all the the capital D and the small D references. So.
Indeed. So we moved to California when I was four and then Hawaii when I was seven. So I spent most of my childhood in the U.S. and in Hawaii.
But, okay.
And then I really haven't been back in the U.S. since. So I left when I was 17 and have been living, I lived 10 years in New Zealand and now 10 years in Asia.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So tell me about the first, you know, your intention kind of behind doing your first, was it a psilocybin retreat or ayahuasca or what did you do?
Yeah, so my first was with ayahuasca. And, you know, for me personally, I guess I had just reached a stage in my career where, and at a stage in my life where I just needed something different. You know, I was leading a team of about 120 consultants when I was with Accenture in Hong Kong.
Oh yeah.
And it was, you know, exactly what you'd expect. Yeah. Lots of projects, lots of clients, lots of sales pressure. And, you know, honestly, I had a great life by any modern standard in Hong Kong, but I was drinking a little bit too much, you know, socially. Yeah. It wasn't problematic, but it comes with
the work, right?
Very much work hard, play hard sort of environment. And I was an atheist, actually. You could not have convinced me that anything spiritual existed.
Yeah.
And I just remember, you know, after a particularly long day and probably a particularly long night, looking myself in the mirror and going, there has to be more to life. You know, the next promotion, the next client, the next deal isn't right. going to give me any improvement to joy of life.
Right.
So I need to try something different. So right. I took a year off and so found my way with some friends to an ayahuasca retreat in Peru.
And where, Peru?
Yeah, in Peru.
Okay. And so what was that like for you in terms of, you know, you had kind of an intention going in, which is, you know, seems to be a kind of an important part of doing this. I mean, like any form of therapy, you kind of have to have some sense of what you're there for, right?
Yeah. And honestly speaking, I was not prepared. I probably didn't have the right intention. I did not have any idea how potentially difficult this could be, at least on the scale that I personally experienced. And it was super, super challenging. So I think if I think way back, the intention that I had would be, I think the intention that I had was around like, what should I do with my time? What should I do with my life? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really deeply anchored. It was just kind of, that was, you know, kind of in the days leading in, I was like, oh, well, that's probably what I should think about. And then, you know, the experience itself was so much more intense than I had expected. That any intentionality for the first ceremony went completely out the window.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, and you and I have talked a little bit about this, but I work in a field more in the kind of alternative holistic health field. But I've worked a lot with chronic pain. I've worked as a manual therapist, craniosacral therapist, movement therapist, and in every single realm, things surface, you know, unavoidably. So someone comes in thinking they're dealing with a cranky hip or lower back or something. And, you know, I'm trained now to kind of work with what comes up in those kind of situations, especially through the craniosacral work that I do. And there have been times where, you know, I see things that almost kind of mirror what happens on, you know, with psilocybin experiences sometimes where it's a There are images that sort of, you know, come to light and you can work with them. And there are things that just you wouldn't suspect to come to the surface, and feelings you wouldn't expect to come to the surface, that then you have to, you know, you have to be there and be, you know, present for. And you know, and there's a lesson in there, and that, you know, in our daily lives, we can get a lot from being present in those kinds of things. But the bridge to those kinds of things can take lots of different forms. And that's kind of where I see this as, you know, I've studied a little bit of the medicinal history of, you know, psychedelics. And I know, you know, what was being done kind of from like the late 30s into the 60s. And it, you know, unfortunately, it seems like it got shut down because of the way that it got used in counterculture, and Timothy Leary, you know, didn't manage it very well, a lot of different things. And I think, and, you know, on some level, the Schedule I status in the United States also, you know, created a problem. But then there was also a lot of problems with research funding and stuff because of what was going on in the 60s with its use. But I think, you know, somewhere in the 90s, you know, there started to become more, just more interest, I guess, from the medical community again of how it could be used for addiction issues and psychosis of, you know, different sorts. And then it seems like with, you know, the John Hopkins study that went on with cancer patients, all of a sudden there's like a huge renewed interest in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think what's interesting is that the current science and the current narrative very much revolves around the potential of plant medicine and psychedelics to alleviate, I would say, alleviate problems that are to do with a lower level of consciousness, right? So PTSD, addiction, depression, anxiety, all of those things are, you know, they reflect a person who's suffering, who's struggling and wants to be doing better. And, you know, honestly speaking, we don't have a great deal that seems to be effective these days to help those people. And so, you know, I see that as kind of the wedge that's been driving the progress in relation to this field. But what I think is still missing from the narrative is, yes, but what we've done in the modern world is we've just set mental health at this subjective bar. And we've said anyone who's below this bar, he needs to get some help from someone so that they can be above the bar. Yeah. And anyone that's above the bar is doing great. They can get back to work and get back to life. And that's fundamentally not it. But the way I look at this work is that we all have a current level of consciousness, and there's no upper bound to the level of consciousness that we can reach. So if we look at any of the great spiritual teachings, if we look at any of the great religions, you know, the messages from the mystics over the ages, it's quite clear that the human potential and the human experience can be much deeper and much broader at higher levels of consciousness. And so that's what I think is most exciting about this work, is that, yeah, we can fix, you know, the people who are suffering, but what about the people who are doing really good? And we can get them to, you know, instead of having egoic motivations that are to do with self and scarcity and am I enough, or can I ever have enough, moving them into levels and places of consciousness where they're coming from a position of love versus fear. And they are connecting with their soul's true desire, because that, you know, that's stored in a higher place. You know, it's not stored in the mind. And so when people connect with those things, then it's very exciting to see the transformations that can take place for them. And, you know, honestly speaking, the path that their lives tend to take is a result of being able to connect with higher levels of consciousness.
And you know, I think that's a term that I think sometimes people can get very sort of scared off by, you know, or just thinking that even that becomes egoic in some ways, to think, oh, I need to be higher than I am. But really what we're trying to, I mean, I think what ends up happening in sort of that higher level is that we realize that we are connected, and that all of our, you know, well-being is dependent on one another and the efforts that we put in for ourselves. And that's a really sort of a hard one, especially in the Western mind. It's not quite as challenging in the Eastern mindset, it seems like, but that's a big one for us to overcome. And so, you know, what is that bridge? You know, I think that this is where I kind of come in with some of my work sometimes is, and I do a lot of coordinating work with, you know, with psychotherapists, mental health people, but also lots of other, you know, forms of medicine. And one of my curiosities for starting this podcast in the first place was sort of asking the question, what is health? You know, what are we trying to become healthier for? What's our intention there? you know? And,
yeah.
And even what is our belief system around how we become or stay well?
I love that. And I mean, I think for us and for the word consciousness, and I like what you called out there in relation to, you know, achieving some higher level of consciousness. And I think it all comes back to connection and vibration, right? To the extent that we are connected in a deep way with our mental, emotional, physical, and energetic body. And then also to the extent that we're connected with those around us. You know, I think there's, I'm sure if you're familiar with some of Patrick Deneen's work.
No.
He wrote the book, Why Liberalism Has Failed, which I think is such a, it's a fascinating book. And he's got a great podcast, I think, Vox. And anyway, in that podcast, he speaks about it's actually what he means is why individualism has failed. And he talks about how on the right, we have a form of government where people believe the market decides who gets what. And on the left, we have a group of people who believe that, you know, government should tax for providing services to its people. And he says, we believe that those are two fundamentally different things. And he goes, that's not exactly right. In both cases, you have a system where people are removed from their responsibilities to their fellow man. And so we're just drifting further and further apart from one another. And we can all see that taking place in America. And so I think, as you know, once we deeply connect with ourselves, then it allows us to deeply connect with others in a way that doesn't revolve around self, which I think is so important.
But before we get into, like, you know, what you're doing with retreats, I'm curious to hear, having lived in, you know, out of the United States for so long, in New Zealand and Thailand, what has that changed your perception of a lot of things?
It has, you know, it really has. Certainly in Asia, people prioritize the collective versus individual needs. And so whereas, you know, when I spend time in the U.S., you can just see everyone expressing themselves very completely and without any reservation of sorts. In Asia, people repress a lot of what they're thinking and a lot of what they're feeling. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually kind of, I would say, two extremes of the spectrum. And also, you know, it's given me a renewed appreciation also for the extent to which America has success and drive built into their DNA. And that, you know, it's incredible. Like, it really is. Like, when in my past work, when I was doing, you know, global transformation programs, you'd talk country to country when we're, you know, deploying new technology into multinationals. And, you know, every country would be like, you know, just being dragged to the starting line is be like, oh, do we have to do this? Why? Can't we just go back and do it the way we did it before? And Americans were always like, all right, let's do this. How do we get it done? And it was just like, wow, there's something really different in the pioneering DNA and mentality that I think is just so inherent within Americans. And it's something that just can't be valued. So that's something that I, you know, over time, I've really gained a renewed appreciation for.
That's interesting. So at what point did you go through, you know, a number of different retreats? Did you try different kinds of therapy on top of this to kind of get into the work that you're doing? What's that background look like?
Yeah. So, you know, as I was sharing before, my first experience with ayahuasca was pretty overwhelming. And so that opened the door to spirituality for me. It gave me a whole bunch of insights and lessons in terms of how to improve my life.
What was so overwhelming about it for you?
Well, it was very physically overwhelming, right? So I ate pretty well, or, you know, by modern city standards, I wasn't too careful in terms of what I was eating, to be honest, on the health side. And like, as I shared before, I was also going out and having a few too many drinks on, you know, Thursday, Fridays, and Saturday nights. And so there was a lot of detoxification to be done. And so for me personally, that took the form of throwing up about 150 times on the first night.
Wow.
So super, super physically intense. And honestly speaking, I wasn't mentally, emotionally, physically, energetically prepared for that experience.
Yeah.
By contrast, my one of my best friends who was there with me, he didn't throw up at all. So that just, you know, that just shows the spectrum of difference of experiences that people can have. And then in terms of, you know, the But I got so much out of it, not so much the first night because it was just too much. But the second night, I got a lot of insights and downloads in relation to my character, how I can turn up for myself and for others in a more beautiful way. And I also got the very strong message that, you know, and this was, you know, when we have these experiences, it's such a powerful message. It's not just like words that come in. It's a very deeply felt sense. I like to describe it sometimes as vertical knowledge. It's almost like this knowledge exists in every cell of your mm-hmm. body. Yeah. And so it's a yeah. very powerful feeling. And one of the big insights that came for me is, you know, the only limitation that you have is yourself. I was like, really? But no, there's all these other circumstances. And then the message just comes, you know, yeah. comes back twice as strong. It's like, no, this is only about, you know, limitations that you place on yourself. And so, yeah. you know, very humbling, but also very empowering at the same time. And yeah. so, then I attended a number of retreats over the years and different medicines. You know, for me personally, my journey was that I would have these powerful experiences. And this is very common in relation to this, have these powerful experiences and insights, and then your life returns to normal. Then, yeah. and so you remember there was like, oh, there was so much there on the retreat, and I felt so good about life and so certain, so positive, I need to go do another retreat. And so I was on that cycle of retreat attendance, you know, probably every 3 to 6 months, I'd take a week and go do another retreat, get some insights and downloads, and then not quite be able to integrate it in the right way.
Yeah.
And then feel like I needed another retreat. So a large part of the motivation for me personally in relation to launching this business has been like, how can I help people avoid my years of mistakes? And they yeah. really were years of mistakes in relation to this work, because the way I see this work now is it's 80% mental and emotional, which is what allows the 20% with plant medicine, psychedelics to be as potentially transformative as it can be. But if you don't do the mental and emotional stuff, you're just going to wind back up where you were before.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And my other question is, I mean, as a health provider and as someone who's kind of looking at some of the challenges that people are struggling with, I mean, I treat a lot of anxiety and depression, and there's always a correlation with pain and other chronic illness, you know. So, you know, I'm interested in these kinds of retreats. Also because I think they're another form, like if people get stuck, that this happens with me a lot. I treat a lot of people through psychotherapists. So when they kind of get stuck in process, they will sometimes send people to me and say, you know, they won't necessarily, you know, prep me for it because they already know what my work is like. But the person coming in knows that they're sort of at this, you know, critical point. And that they're pretty, the nice thing about, you know, my work is that I feel like people come in and they're kind of ready to work. They have a very clear intention. They know exactly what they're doing. I'm not just getting, you know, random people coming into a clinic, you know, as urgent care or something, as doctors have to deal with people. Right. So the nice thing is that from that perspective, I have a different, you know, skill set or tool set than the therapist does. But I, the way that I look at you know, psychedelics is that it's another tool in the box, basically. I think there could be something there that, especially when you look at the history of you know, if you look at some of the early research in terms of how well it dealt with addiction issues, it's unbelievable. It's there has been nothing really that has worked as well as psychedelics, you know, with, you know, usually therapy, you know, therapist guided, you know, work, but still. That says a lot about what might be going on at that low level, as you call it, you know, that all those kind of baseline things that are going on with people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, if we were to put numbers to it, I think, you know, 97% of people have been traumatized early in their lives, right? And so whether that's related to childbirth or childhood, we often don't even know, right? So we repress these memories because the brain correctly recognizes them as trauma. And so compartmentalizes that memory away as a defense mechanism. And so the neurogenetic effects of these tools really do reconnect the brain. And there's some great research from 2014 where it shows the effects of psilocybin on the brain. And what you can see is, you know, typical modern Western brain is highly patterned in terms of the neural pathways that are being used and overused, actually. So National Science Foundation did some great work to show that your typical person has between 12 and 60,000 thoughts per day. Almost 100% of those thoughts, pretty much 100% of those thoughts are egoic thoughts. So I, me, my. And then 95% of those thoughts are repetitive, and 85% of those thoughts are negative. So we're thinking a ton. Yeah. We're thinking only about ourselves. We're thinking the same things about ourselves, yeah. and almost all of those things are bad. Yeah. And it's like, oh my God. Yeah. And so then it showed an MRI scan of the brain with the effects of psilocybin. And what it shows is, you know, a much higher degree of interconnectivity between regions of the brain that normally don't communicate. And so I think, you know, that plays a fundamental role in terms of decompartmentalization of the brain. The easy example I sometimes give is, if you've got someone who says they love their wife, and at the same time they're cheating on their wife, that is an example of a physically compartmentalized brain. Those are two thoughts that are incongruent with one another.
Right.
And so when people have these experiences and the brain is decompartmentalized and harmonized, then there needs to be a reconciliation between these sorts of incongruent thoughts. And we have, and for most people, we don't even recognize how bad our own brains are, because it's just, that's just who we are. We've over-identified with our mind, and we think of mind as self. And so to disidentify with that, or begin to look at what that thing, how that thing is actually treating us, is not a pretty process for most of us.
Yeah. I think it's interesting the way that we process trauma or not even are aware of something that may have been really kind of critical in our development. Like, so I treat babies too. That's one of the things that I treat newborns. Oh, wow. I mean, not just babies, but brand new ones. And it's been interesting over the years, because I've been treating babies for maybe 17, 18 years, something like that. So one of the things that I've seen sort of over and over again is that, you know, there are these, because I'm very focused on kind of this autonomic nervous system response, which is like our fight or flight, rest, digest, and they have to be in balance for us to sort of, you know, be harmonious, maybe at that cellular level even. When you have a baby who comes out and its perception of things is that there's a lot of challenge going on and they're unhappy and they become tighter and they kind of ball up into, you know, and curled fists and all these things. And the one thing that I found interesting is that sometimes the mom can have a very beautiful birth experience. That doesn't mean the baby had the same experience, you know? And so that says a lot about, you know, it's not always about, you know, what we're doing as parents. You know, sometimes we come into the world with a subset, and sometimes there's stuff that's going on from, you know, the time period that the gestation was happening, and sometimes there's an epigenetic part where, you know, we come from families of trauma, and that kind of somehow works itself in, whether it's an energy or whether it's, you know, carried forward, starting to see more evidence that it's actually there in the cellular material. And so that's, you know, that's one of those things that I think we should all just sort of assume that from the beginning, especially based on what you're saying from this study in 2014, that if we look at our you know, conscious patterning, that tells us a lot about what we're actually all kind of going through and collectively, most likely.
Yeah, that's very well said, very well said. And I think there's just a first paper that's come out, I think 2 months ago or so now, showing epigenetic changes from plant medicine. So it's the first, I think, clinical trial, first science of psychedelics and epigenetics. And so I think that's just beginning to understand what's possible. You know, some of the spiritual teachers and mentors that I've been blessed to learn from over the years, a lot of their focus is on the genetic side of things, but from a spiritual understanding, not from a scientific understanding. And so trying to reactivate a lot of dormant DNA, you know, when you hear about these things that are still not recognized and acknowledged by science, like clairvoyance and telepathy, et cetera, a lot of that has to do with, obviously, number one, the third eye, the pineal gland, but also genetic expression and reconnecting mind, body, heart, and spirit. In the ways that they can be connected without the child trauma and the birth trauma and the childhood trauma, et cetera.
Yeah, well, and it's starting to become clear to me. I mean, I'm very drawn to science. I'm very drawn to research. I'm a data person in many ways, but I'm also somebody who like feels subtlety with his hands every day and is working with these kinds of things and has studied energy medicine for 25 years. So, like, I think there is a marrying that's naturally going on all the time between this science and you know, when the deeper you go into the science, the more you kind of see the way interconnectedness happens. And to me, that's sort of the foundation of any spiritual practice. And I think that's, you know, where when we kind of get stuck in that individual mindset and can't quite get out of that way of seeing things, things like psychedelics can actually sort of free that up and just basically open up a perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
Better than I've seen a lot of pharmaceuticals anyways.
Yeah. And you know, there's it's one of the things that surprised me recently. There's a gentleman that I speak to regularly. He goes by the handle of the psychedelic scientist. And what he shared with me, there's been a theory around for a long time called the stoned ape theory.
Right.
And that's the whole thing that
is McKenna, right?
It is McKenna, indeed. Yeah. And now he says within academic circles, there's a broad acceptance for that theory, which really surprised me, actually. And he said that I think it's Harvard should be coming out with some stuff, I think late this year or early next year, in relation to that, which is going to provide a pretty strong scientific basis for the fact that it's not that these medicines do interesting things to our brains. It's that our brains are as interesting as they are, potentially in no small part, as a result of these medicines. So we may have actually co-evolved with them, which could change the understanding quite drastically.
Yeah, I've read some of that stuff. I mean, I know the other thing is that they never wanted it to be called the stoned ape theory. They thought that was a really dumbing down of what they were trying to, you know, get at with this, because I think there's, I forget what the time period is, but I think it's somewhere around like 40,000 years ago, they see a big shift that happened in terms of, you know, language, cognitive abilities, you know, sort of creativity, what we would call creativity. So drawing and even just world exploration, you know, they started to kind of like, you know, believe there was more out there, which, you know, they think may have come from them finding some mushrooms accidentally.
Yeah. And to link it back to, as one of our advisors shared with me, well, you know, that's the reason that explosion in the prefrontal cortex is a large part of why our birthing process is so traumatic. You know, you look at all the other mammals and they're getting it done pretty quickly and pretty easily out there in the wild. And by contrast for us humans, because we've got these, you know, big heads at birth, it's a much more difficult process. And yeah. I was like, wow, that's quite an interesting observation.
Yeah. So let's get into the retreat. So I'm curious to you know, see what you've kind of decided to do in terms of, you know, from your experience, how you've designed this. I know that it's like a 7-week course of sorts, right? And that you have a lot of prep time that's not, you know, you have 1 week where you're together, you know, doing something, but there's kind of like a preparatory period, I think, and then also stuff that goes on afterwards, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I think, you know, as I shared earlier, one of the primary mistakes that I was making is skipping the mental and emotional work. And the other one is kind of going into these big groups, right? Big group retreats. And so what we're trying to do is to do something that's much more individualized to the person's needs, right? So what we do over the 7 weeks is to help people get really clear on future self, right? These medicines really do respond to intentionality.
Yes.
And so to the extent that we anchor to an understanding of our future selves, you know, I truly believe that any one of us can become whoever we want to be.
Yeah.
And so as we anchor to a future version of ourselves that we aspire to, then we can surface the limiting thought patterns, the limiting beliefs, you know, and we often teach people how to connect more deeply with their emotions and begin to release their emotions as well, in preparation for the retreat. And so then that allows for a really deep intention for the retreat that relates to the ego structure rather than something that is, you know, potential to bypass the ego structure.
So can you explain that a little bit in terms of like what you do for the emotional, you know, to kind of get people connected in that way? Because in my work, I find that's one of the most helpful things, and it's one of the things that's most challenging for people. You know, they either have like sort of heart-centered issues, they have trouble expressing verbally, or, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah. So, you know, it's often our nervous system is, as you well know, it's pretty shot, right? So we use our minds for these things, and our bodies for those things. And yeah, there's a connection between the two, but there's not this real felt sense of the whole. And you know, if I wind back personally 5 years ago, I would have been like, what are you talking about? But like, as you really connect mind, body, heart, and spirit in the ways that they're meant to be connected, you're like, oh, now I get it. And so what we do for clients is, we provide a few different tools, right? So there's, many ways to skin the cat, as it were. And it depends upon the individual in terms of what works for them. So for some people, they're able to connect relatively easily through meditation. For some people, breath work can be a great tool to just feel a little bit more, get a little bit more sensitivity in the physical and energetic body. And, you know, we often try to find, you know, help people use their triggers as the window, right? So whenever that moment comes where there's emotions that rise to the surface, oh, great. So now do the process of releasing those. So, you know, the process that we typically guide clients through is in relation to, you know, allowing, first and foremost, allowing the emotion, trying to label the emotion in a descriptive way, and then deciding, oh, well, can I allow this emotion? Could I let go of this emotion? Would I let go of this emotion? So just taking them through that process through therapy and coaching sessions, you know, helping them tap into the emotions that they are struggling with, both through history as well as kind of in modern times. You know, we all have those people or those moments in life that can trigger us. And so that's an opportunity. That's a window.
It's a lot of identification kind of stuff going on, right? Because it's hard to, you know, if you've never done any work around this, identifying, you know, where you actually struggle is step one.
Yeah, absolutely. And then being able to respond versus react, right? Because we often react and we don't create that space for ourselves. And usually you can't get it right immediately, right? Usually, I mean, we've got these entrenched patterns. And so I always say to people, you know, be patient with yourself. You are trying to rewire your mind. You are trying to, you know, renew your emotional body. And so just try and get faster at recognizing, oh, I shouldn't have been so angry there, and then go process your emotions, come back, and then try and do a little bit better. You know, one of the meditation teachers that I really respect, he says, look, if you can become 5% less angry per year, you know, accrue that over the rest of your lifetime, that's incredible.
I work that way too. I think that's important. Yeah. Just thinking small bits.
Yeah. And, you know, some of our clients over that 7-week process, they're pushing themselves really hard. And it's like, yes, but make sure that that's coming from a loving place, right? Because you are perfect as you are. You are perfect. And I truly believe
we're,
that.
Like, we're not achieving anything. Right.
Exactly. Like, you are really perfect as you are, and you can be better. And that's a paradox. And that's the beauty of life.
Yeah.
So helping people make that shift from like, oh, I'm not good enough. I need to be this. I need to be that, to like, it's okay. I'm okay. And things can improve, and applying more of that sort of energy to the process.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such an interesting thing, because even with this kind of work, and I see it in mental health work as well, is like there's always this, you know, whatever's beyond the horizon. You think there's something that's always going to be, you know, beyond if you keep pushing and keep pushing, but really the peace comes from being okay with where we are with everything right now, which means, you know, accepting what we're challenged by and, you know, our faults and all these different pieces, which is, I think, also another one of those things that people tend to come to terms with, I think, when they do have experiences like this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we've all been guilty at some points of time of, you know, when you drive a wedge between what is and what you'd like to be true, that's a very painful place to be. It's horrible, right?
Because you're basically
at odds with reality itself, and it's unlikely that reality is going to change at the, you know, at the drop of a hat. And so it's all about harmonization, you know, harmonization within, and then harmonization with the outside world as well. And so, you know, as we attune ourselves to the lessons that the universe is constantly trying to send us in terms of our next opportunity to elevate consciousness, then the game of life takes on a completely different shape and form, because we're just seeing it as feedback, as stimulus, as messages. And how we deal with that is really up to us. And so, you know, just in taking a curious mindset to like, what is it that I'm meant to be learning here or meant to be seeing here that I haven't seen before, because there's always something there. And that really becomes a magic. When clients get that and they make that shift, it's magical to see them make that transition to like, oh, I'm being sent all these messages, and as opposed to seeing hardship and challenge and negativity and victimized by the outside world. It's beautiful.
Well, that's the interesting thing is I think so many of us, and I struggle sometimes with like the term PTSD because suddenly everybody has PTSD. And I'm not saying that people don't, because there are clearly some really, bad things that I treat a lot of this stuff in my practice. And I lived in New York during 9/11. I mean, I know some of the things that people go through, but sometimes we just had really bad experiences, our business failed, our marriage failed. That's not necessarily PTSD, but I think it can set us into this path of what you were talking about of just reactivity to things, right? We kind of like overstimulate that sympathetic nervous system, that fight or flight response. And suddenly like we can get so patterned into thinking like every situation is sort of there to demean us, or that we become victimized by every place that we go. And I think that's the part that we are, in terms of the work that you're doing and in terms of the work that I do on a day-to-day basis, I'm trying to get people into this mindset of not being overly reactive, but to respond, as you're saying, like to be able to sit with that and say, okay, how do I feel about this, rather than just like feeling really loudly the first thing that comes out.
100%. We did a survey recently and it found that 46% of the survey group, American survey group, they believed that they were the best person that they know. And when I first saw that statistic, I was just shocked. I was like, what? Like, yeah. I don't get me wrong. Like what we do for our clients is try to help them build their self-image, right? In the right sort of non-egoic sort of a way. Right. But it just shows that, there's in the levels of consciousness that we use, pride features very strongly. Oh, and so yeah, I think a lot of Americans are in that place where like, yeah, I'm there and I'm this. And it's like, and so they externalize a lot of that versus the internalization. And I see that within some of my friends and also their, brothers and sisters, where they really externalize everything. Like there's something out there that is always at fault. And I think through the schooling system in the US, there's a real you're perfect the way you are, which, I think to a degree is true. But then people deflect. They're just unwilling to look at any of their own stuff. It's all on the outside versus, through this work, you come to realize, there's the only type of knowledge is self-knowledge. And so anything that's out there that you don't like says something about you. It doesn't say anything about the thing that's out there. That's just an expression of consciousness. It's just there's some trigger there. There's some opportunity there for you to look into for yourself and to try to release.
Yeah. And the other thing that, I think, especially right now, as we're kind of, I really feel like we're all going to be kind of going through a recovery process with the pandemic. And I have a good close doctor friend who has been sort of talking about this for years, that people in the medical world need to have, something like this sometimes as a recovery tool, because I can only imagine. I mean, I'm not in a health field that's being hit quite as hard by what's going on with COVID in the U.S., but I think there are a lot of people, and just the politicization of what's going on with it too. It's something that people really need to have, I think, some support to kind of get back to a baseline of themselves. And I think, what his idea was to have some kind of a retreat center where because the other thing is that medical people are like notoriously terrible about like going to the doctor themselves and getting the basic workups and having a physical done and blood work and all this stuff. But that, with that, in that same kind of place that we could have, some movement therapies, meditation, body work, manual therapy type stuff like I do, and possibly some, ayahuasca or psilocybin as a way to kind of, again, just another tool in that way of being able to kind of change the perspective. Because I find in my work a lot of times, especially whether it comes to pain or depression or anxiety, we're trying to shift the narrative that we have, and a lot of that narrative, as we've been talking about, is very self-identified and a belief system that, a lot of times that either falsely that they are completely enough, like they're important, and one of the best people that they know, or that they're the worst person, you know, like that. Those are the things that I think, you know, people kind of get stuck in most of the time, or that the experiences that they have, or that, you know, the parents that they had or whatever are the reason that they struggle, rather than, you know, being able to just step into the responsibility that we all struggle. And we should all be doing some kind of self-work on a regular basis, whatever it is. Maybe it's, you know, maybe these kinds of retreats, or, you know, seeing a psychotherapist, you know, manual therapist, whatever it is that kind of helps them free up some of that, that old patterning and that old kind of cognitive dissonance that kind of gets stuck in us somatically.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. I think there's a lot more people that want to take a more holistic approach to their health. You know, actually, my mother was recently diagnosed with stage 3 in her remaining kidney. And, you know, it was shocking that the medical world really had no answers. And so we're pursuing some different paths. And I think a lot more people are taking responsibility back into their own hands. And I think COVID has really triggered that to a great extent.
Yeah,
you know, it's
so
been
too.
Really interesting. There's so much focus on and I'm not, you know, pro or anti-vax, but there's so much focus on that specifically.
Yeah.
And there's no focus on breath work. There's no focus on meditation, cellular health, immune system, exercise, sunlight. And I'm just like, where, like, if ever there was a time for the television to just make a big switch and be like, look, 30 minutes a day, here's what you need to know in relation to taking care of your health. And just sickness, all we're talking about is sickness. And it's like, what about health? Like, why can't we talk about health? And so I think there's a lot more people who are like, okay, I want to be well. I don't want to be talking about sickness. I want to be talking about health. And, and that's going to be the frame of mind that allows me to be healthy.
Right.
And so I think COVID is, you know, in many shapes, you know, there's no doubt there's a lot of downsides, but I think it has many blessings to it as well, in terms of what it's bringing to the surface for many of us.
Yeah. And that's, you know, back to what you kind of started out with earlier, this wellness, this sort of like our potential to be whatever higher level of ourselves we can be is unlimited. We like to think that, you know, once we don't have any physical symptomatic stuff going on, that we're just good. But I think, you know, that this is one of those things that I, from being in this field for so long, is I think health is about really being present to this opportunity of life. And I think that's one of the things that people just, you know, they really struggle to stay in that space. And that, you know, the reason I wanted to talk to you is because I feel like there's something going on here with, you know, using a guided retreat like this, that might actually be like a tuning fork of sorts, you know, to be able to do that on a regular enough basis. But realistically, I think we can't expect too much from just doing something once either. You know what I mean? I've worked with a lot of people who have been to some retreats in different places in the world, and they come back with, you know, some really amazing epiphanies, but you still got to do the work, just as you do in any sort of therapy.
100%. And that's a large part of what we're there's more science out there which is pointing to that, you know, because what you typically find is in the clinical world, they're paying attention to the mental and emotional work, and they have no idea what's happening in relation to the energetic work. Like, just no idea. So the current, the current paradigm in terms of psychedelic medicine is, oh, we need another 10,000 psychedelic therapists to go through a 2-year course at, you know, one of the universities. And it's kind of like, that's helpful. But they're missing the energetic aspect. And so the shamans and, you know, the ancient wisdom traditions, they don't really do so much on the mental and emotional stuff. They focus on the energetic stuff. And so we're starting to see those worlds merge in a way that it's like, okay, now this is getting very exciting.
That's cool.
Because it's the holistic approach, which is, of course, what's required in order to raise the vibration.
Yeah. So what have you guys decided to do in terms of, I'm sure you have a pretty good team of people now who have to be involved in this. Where do they come from in terms of training, and how do you select people, and even how do you select, or how do you screen for, you know, having the people in, you know, who want to be part of the retreats?
Yeah, so there's a rational answer and a spiritual answer to your question. And so the rational is what you would expect in relation to, there's no, in this line of work, there's no replacement for experience. Like, you just, how many years have you been doing this work makes a massive difference, because, you know, these are powerful experiences. And so There are patterns, of course, that emerge. You know, I think we all like to think of ourselves as so different, but people who've worked in this space for 20 or 30 years, they very quickly know exactly what you need to work on. You know, a few sentences in, they're going to go, yeah, I got it. and so there's a lot there, and so we definitely look for experience. You know, there's most of our practitioners have been doing this work for between 15 and 30 years, you know, the other dynamic is that most people who enjoy doing the retreats and the facilitation, the medicine work, they don't really enjoy doing the mental and emotional work, right? So we bring together the coaches and the therapists to help people prepare for these experiences. And then we send them to the people who enjoy doing the medicine work, right, and the retreat work. So we're certainly looking for experience. The spiritual answer to that is we're looking for people who have achieved and sustained a higher level of consciousness. And so people who are very energetically adept are able to tune into other people's level of consciousness. Right, because it's all energetic, and so they're able to see the vibration that people are at. And the reason that we're looking for that is because there is a harmonization that takes place. You know, if you've heard the term the benediction of the guru, or if you look again at any of the great religious teachers over time, a large part of what people were wanting to do was to spend time in their physical presence, because, you know, to use physics language, when there's two frequencies, the low frequency harmonizes towards the higher frequency. Yeah. And so I think, you know, speaking on more of a collective scale, I think a lot of what we see ourselves going through at the moment is an attempting, you know, is harmonization between people who are at different frequencies. There's people who see the groups of people who see the world very differently from others. And as a result of that, there's things that are being thrown out of balance, or attempting to harmonize as a result of that. And so that's really what we're looking for when it comes to practitioners, is lots of experience, and they're able to bring people to a higher place, because fundamentally they themselves have reached a higher place.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even in my work, I find that there's a big part of my work that's about really staying neutral to lots of different types of personalities, you know, which is not always easy. And also kind of to what you're saying with, you know, with this harmonization and even working on this energetic level. Are, you know, the thing about our nervous systems, our consciousness, and our, you know, the energy that kind of comes through this. We are kind of tuning forks, and we can really like pick up a lot of information. And I would have, you know, at the beginning of my career, I would have said this is kind of a lot of hoo-ha, but I've had these experiences when I'm working with people, and they, especially if they have a memory, or if they have an image or you know, something that takes them to a very specific place. And I'm asking them questions about what's going on. And I'm very grounded in the body when I'm working with people, and maybe it helps to have, you know, for me to have hands on them while I'm doing it. But, you know, they can be describing, you know, a specific place in time with a, you know, a loved one in a specific room, telling me the details. And I swear, I feel like I'm right in that space with them. And it sounds kind of crazy, but I think I am able to kind of tune into what's going on. And it's almost as if when I'm at that level, because really the way I think about my work, you may think about this, your work as well this way, but that I'm facilitating a process. I'm not there to tell them what to do. You know, I'm really there to sort of be present for their process. And so I imagine that's a lot of what needs to go on with these people who are spending their time with, you know, on the retreats.
Exactly right. And so when I first started working with private healers, you know, because a lot of what we do is group work, but we do private work as well. When I started working with some private healers, and the first ceremony that I did with them, it's a couple, and they work together. They've got a lovely family. And the moment the ceremony started, her first thing was, Jesus Christ, how much video games have you played? So she was seeing the release of all of these images from my video game addiction, from when I was, you know, I played video games probably 18 hours a day from when I was like 13 to 17, like as much as possible. I was really into it. She was overwhelmed by the energy. She's like, wow, how much video games did you play? We had never talked about video games before that. And she was, I mean, the extent to what she could see was just incredible. It was just like, she could see everything. And then her husband is super talented in the sense that he's really able to go into other people's physical bodies. So actually transplant his consciousness into someone else. And I know this sounds pretty out there and abstract,
right,
but once you actually have the feeling of someone else going into you energetically and releasing out the things that are blocking you, it was just like, wow, that's really quite something. And it sounds like you're doing something very similar when you're working with people in your osteopath.
Yeah. And to think, you know, for some people who think this is crazy, I mean, anyone who's ever fallen in love has had that sort of experience. You know, there's some kind of merging that goes on. And I think there's a healing process that goes on with that. And I think we can get very focused on, like, you know, it's the sort of romantic notion that the West has anyways of what these love relationships are supposed to look like, and that there's only one person for you and all this stuff. I think if we took that outside of the, you know, that and thought about our, you know, our communities and our, you know, all of our friendships and all of our, you know, things that we sort of come into contact with that same kind of energy, we would probably be able to feel more of what's going on energetically. And it's much, you know, for me, because I'm doing this work all the time, it feels like energy now feels very, you know, tangible. I don't think about it as you know, a non-material thing.
Absolutely. And for me, you know, for me personally, it's like the degree to which I can feel vibration in my body now as a result of this work and cleaning up diet and all of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
It's like I feel like I can really just feel like vibration on a cellular level in my body. And, you know, like I made the mistake a couple of weeks ago of a friend was visiting and I had just literally I had one drink, and for 3 days I was just like, I was out of it. It really rocked me energetically. Yeah. And that was just one drink, you know, and it was just like, I don't think I'll ever touch another one ever again.
Huh.
And equally, you know, like, a friend invited me to a party, and a very nice group of people, you know, a few more on the, I would say on the alternative side. And I had been to a similar party before. And I just find myself now, I find myself too energetically sensitive to be in a group of people like that. I pick up on a lot of their energies and I feel it.
I have the same challenge.
I can feel it. Yeah, you could feel it in your physical body. And it took me, again, a couple of days to actually be able to clear out the energies that I had picked up from other people. Yeah. And so, you know, so it's fascinating to I guess gain command of the mental, the physical, emotional, and energetic well-being of self. And it was, you know, again, I would have 5 years ago, I would have laughed at anyone who was describing what I've just described here, because I've been like, you've lost it. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, whatever, dude.
Exactly.
So with the retreats, I know you're starting to do them in different places too. So where are you, you know, setting up for these retreats?
Yeah, so at the moment, most of our work takes place in Mexico, Costa Rica, Portugal, and the Netherlands. We're definitely, we'll reopen in Peru once they're in better shape. It's unfortunately, COVID has really hit them hard. You know, all really beautiful locations. I think it's so nice. I always recommend to my friends, like, look, take a week, take 10 days and really just, you know, be able to remove yourself from the pressures of everyday life. I think, you know, there's an aspect of American culture of like, oh, I can just, you know, drive 2 hours and do this on the weekend. It's like, yeah, you can, but like, I think you're important. I think you're more important than that. And I think this work is more important than that. I'm not trying to discourage people from doing, you know, shorter experiences, but to be able to take the time and the space to really go deep with yourself over a week and then give yourself a few more days, I think is a beautiful way to
afterwards to kind of, you know, I do the same thing with my work. I don't give people days, but I, you know, a lot of people will come to their, you know, 1 hour or 90 minute appointment with me and then want to just go right back to work and feeling like, okay, did my work back to life. But I always say, you know, take some time if you can to just, you know, sit in that sense of how you feel, and, you know, journal or go for a walk or anything that may kind of help to, you know, bring you, you know, maybe you'll pick up a little more information even just from being in that space for a little longer. And I always say that, you know, the session is the place where you do the work, but, you know, afterwards is where you start to kind of, you know, come up with your ideas about how you're going to integrate this.
Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what we do for the 3 weeks after with our clients is like, okay, you've had this powerful, profound experience, but how are you going to actually use this to improve your quality of life? Because you didn't, you know, I always say to people, you don't want to go on an ayahuasca retreat or a bufo retreat. What you're looking for is improvements to quality of life. And this is a tool that you'd like to use to get there. So, you know, it's just, you know, I think you said it perfectly. It's just a tool. How we use it is what makes the biggest difference.
Yeah. Cool, man. This has been such a great time. I want to try to stay connected with you and get some more info too. So if there's ever anything that, you know, as you guys are kind of putting more new things together, if there's, you know, ever any resource that you can share, I know you and I talked before about, I really want you to write something for me. So to share to people, I think it's important to demystify some of this too. And to actually make, you know, have it be something that, I mean, with spiritual matters, you know, I think it's never quite concrete. I think everyone's experience on some level is going to be different, but I do think that there's a cohesiveness in terms of, you know, how we end up together after doing this kind of work, where we feel, you know, more connected, or we feel better about each other and that kind of thing. So I'd like to you know, continue to get more of your perspective.
Beautiful. Well, always happy to share. You know, for me, it's again, the motivation is just to help people avoid the years of mistakes that I made. So always happy to put good information out there. We do, we guide a lot of our prospective clients. We have a 1-hour webinar on our website where I just try to, you know, help people understand the mistakes that I made. And so that's, you know, a beautiful resource for people to say, oh, okay, well, here's a few things that I might avoid. And I always say, look, whether or not you work with us, like, here's a few things that you probably really benefit from knowing.
Okay, cool. And I'll have all links up on our YouTube channel and on the show notes too. So if, you know, whoever's listening right now can just check that out right now. Click on your website and any links to anything that you want to share as well.
Beautiful.
All right. Thanks, Jonathan. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Jonathan DePotter, folks. I find this to be a very exciting topic, especially at a time when so many of us are living with the fear of an uncertain future, due in part to the pandemic, but also because of where human progress has led us. I don't think I'm alone in pondering what the future holds for humans on this planet if we don't heal these lower parts of ourselves and move toward a greater understanding of our responsibility to ourselves, to each other, and to our precious ecosystem. After this conversation, I found myself thinking, we have drugs for physical and emotional health challenges, but what if the challenge is a spiritual one in nature? And shouldn't our spiritual state be considered part of our health equation? When we're overwhelmed, we learn to desensitize, tune out, and eventually shut down. This is not a state for healing, and certainly not one for enlightenment. I approach this topic as someone who addresses these challenges daily in my practice, and my interest is in how we can best leverage this plant-based medicine to improve our state of being. In the case of people who are suffering and really struggling to find hope in their lives, this should be a therapeutic option in our country, but I don't see it happening anytime soon. Until then, you'll have to travel outside of the United States and seek support for this kind of work. If you're interested in learning more about what Jonathan and his team do, check out Behold Retreats. That's behold-retreats.com. And let me know you thought of this topic in conversation. You can reach out to me anytime through the contact page of our website, highway2.health. And if you'd like to watch us have this conversation, head over to Highway to Health podcast channel on YouTube. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.
If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Medicine in America, hosted by Anthony Manson and Todd Harrington, shares the stories of physicians, other healthcare professionals, and industry leaders who are changing the way we deliver care. There's an episode that you should check out called Primary Care Reimagined with Subscription-Based Preventative Care Model. It's an inspiring call for a paradigm shift in primary care. All of their episodes highlight innovative ideas at the forefront of the movement to transform our healthcare system. Check out Medicine in America on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.